You in a couple of minutes.
We will have the latest from Lebanon as British people are urged to leave immediately.
And our In My Opinion today, there is nothing wrong with swearing in sport. Actually, it can have benefits in terms of performance. Let us know what you think.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
And here are the news headlines at 6 o'clock. Sir Keir Starmer has issued a blunt warning to UK nationals still in Lebanon to leave immediately after voicing his fears the Middle East could be on the brink of all-out war. Sir Keir says the government's making urgent contingency plans in the wake of the escalating violence between Israel and Hezbollah. The Ministry of Defence is sending troops to Cyprus to help with a possible evacuation from Lebanon.
The Prime Minister is attending the annual UN General Assembly, and before heading to New York, he sat down with me. You can hear the full interview in a moment. One of the topics I challenged him on was about donations of clothing and gifts.
Now we're in government, I think, if you take, for example, clothing, I think that's, you know, when the hurly-burly of an election campaign is one thing. We're in government now, and so you won't see clothing declarations from me again.
So will MPs be able to take freebies in other forms outside of clothing, Labour MPs?
Well, I think every MP has to exercise judgment, and I would expect them to exercise judgment.
So you're not
judgment.
Banning all gifts?
Well, you have to exercise judgment. I expect people to exercise judgment. And the rules in place, the framework, is quite rightly that all has to be declared so that everybody can see it.
Senior sources have told the BBC the government's message that the NHS in England is broken could have an impact on staff morale. The Department of Health says it's being honest about the challenges facing the health service.
Prosecutors in the US have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Routh, who's 58, was already facing two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month. He hasn't yet entered a plea. Our North America correspondent is David Willis.
Ryan Routh is being held in custody. The prosecution has claimed that he presents a potential flight risk. But if found guilty of this very serious charge of the attempted assassination of the former president, he faces the possibility of life in prison. This was, of course, the second such attempt on Donald Trump's life. 2 months ago, a man opened fire during a campaign rally in Pennsylvania.
And according to a global study, children's eyesight is steadily getting worse, with one in three now short-sighted or unable to see things in the distance clearly. Researchers say COVID lockdowns had a negative impact on eyesight as children spent more time on screens and less time outdoors. The highest rates of short-sightedness are in Japan, Korea and Russia. Let's get our first weather check-in of the day with Helen Willetts. Morning, Helen.
Hi, Claire. I'm not sure this is one that many want to hear, to be quite honest with you. It's not a great-looking day. We've had that brief window of drier weather yesterday, but more rain's on the way, really concerning me for the southern half of the UK because we've still got over 30 flood warnings after Monday's rain. Let's start, though. Scotland, scattered showers, northern and western areas becoming more frequent as the chilly northeasterly wind sets in. Best of the sunshine through the central bend, I think, today. It's a cold start, though. A few places down to frost levels, getting up to perhaps 13 today in the central belt. It's a similar story for Northern Ireland. It's a chilly start. There could be a little bit of mist and fog around as well. But then good spells of sunshine till late afternoon. Cloud thickens, rain comes up from the south. But we'll still see, I think, 12, 13 as our highs. For England and Wales, though, we've already got showers ahead of the main rain, which is marching its way in already to the Isles of Scilly and Cornwall. It'll make its way across much of southwest England, Wales, the Midlands, northwest England through the day, showers ahead of it, and then the rain reaching all parts, I think, of England and Wales by the end of play. Some heavy rain, perhaps another inch to fall, strong winds through the channel. So as you can imagine, temperatures will struggle. We might see 17 if the sun does come out.
And how about the sport, Katie? What's going on?
Morning. Well, England's standing captain Harry Brooke hit a first ODI century yesterday to help the host win a rain-affected third match against Australia. So they won by 46 runs on the DLS method in Durham. And crucially, that means they keep the series alive. So England now trailing Australia 2-1 with two matches left to play. All four Premier League teams in action last night made it through to the fourth round of the EFL Cup. Leicester, though, had to squeeze past League Two Walsall on penalties. Chelsea comfortably beat Barrow, 5-0 at Stamford Bridge. There was a hat-trick for Christopher Nkunku. Aston Villa won 2-1 at Wycombe Wanderers, and Manchester City beat Watford 2-1. Afterwards, Pep Guardiola said midfielder Rodri will be out for a long time, but they are still waiting for doctors to confirm the severity of the injury. That was the one he picked up at the weekend. And there was gold for Kat Ferguson, Felix Barrow and Fran Brown as Great Britain won 9 medals on day 4 at the Road and Paracycling World Championships in Zurich.
The Voice of the UK.
This is 5 Live Breakfast.
Morning, everyone. How are you doing this morning? So after the show yesterday, I went over to Liverpool to interview the Prime Minister. He was doing a series of interviews after his speech, his big set-piece speech at the conference. And we'll bring you that in just a moment. We'll play you the full interview and take you behind the scenes a bit as well, because it's just interesting understanding the way these things work. But events have also sort of slightly overtaken that, because the situation in Lebanon is now getting very serious. The Prime Minister telling British nationals to leave. There are plans to evacuate any British citizens that are left behind, can't get on commercial flights. So we'll, of course, reflect on that throughout the programme as well this morning.
Yes, also got a very interesting guest. She is a co-founder of a group called Mercury 13. She's Victoire Gojinvina Renal. And this is all about investing an awful lot of money in women's football here in the UK. The plan is to invest 80 million in transforming women's clubs around the world. Their sights are set on the UK as well. So Victoire is going to be joining us after 7 this morning.
Our In My Opinion today is all about swearing in sport. And this is after the slightly potty-mouthed rant from Max Verstappen at the weekend in a press conference when he wasn't very happy about the performance of his car.
I think that's correct.
We're going to talk to someone who's done research into this and says, actually, swearing can really improve the way you play sport, the way you perform. So what are the rules as far as you're concerned, maybe in your house when your kids are playing? I probably think most people don't tolerate swearing on a pitch from young kids. Mm. That wouldn't really be acceptable, but as an adult, I mean, I play football, walking football.
Yeah.
Competitive walking football.
Do you swear? Do you swear at that?
It does sometimes.
Really?
Frustrations with myself occasionally
walking football
spill out.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying it's not competitive.
I don't know if it makes me any better, though.
No. Well, I maybe...
Swearing when I'm being penalised for walking too fast.
Maybe he's talking about elite level. No offence, but, you know, offence.
Maybe.
Yeah, so swearing, he's saying... I mean, he's going to come on and say, you know, in elite sport it's good, but generally, it'd be quite like to hear from you this morning, where you draw the line with swearing. And if it's okay for kids to do that on a pitch, I guess we're giving you the sports psychologist view that, yes, it is. It improves performance, but do get in touch. 850-58.
Also, we're going to be talking about Bake Off, which returned last night, which was just lovely, I have to say. And before 7 o'clock this morning, new research which has come out about the addiction that people are vulnerable to on different kinds of tech devices, but social media in particular, and how that impacts on brain development. Look, it's something that we've sort of talked around for a long time now, but this is new research from the University of Glasgow. So we'll talk to one of the people involved in that study before 7 o'clock. It's 7 minutes past six. So as I mentioned, Sir Keir Starmer has warned Britain still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. Speaking on board a plane to New York, where he will attend the annual UN General Assembly, the Prime Minister said the government was ramping up contingency plans. British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations.
Before he got on that plane, though, Rach, as you were saying, you managed to get an interview with him, didn't you, at the Labour Party press conference in Liverpool?
Yeah, so we went over there. We didn't get into the conference itself for his speech because it was absolutely jammers there. So we watched from a hotel where there were still loads of delegates and members watching, and was warmly received by the crowds who we were with, as you'd expect, I guess. And then you go through security, you get filtered through, you wait around, you get told to eventually go to a room where a series of journalists are waiting in a long corridor, speaking in hushed tones, sort of sharing notes, but not too much about what they're going to ask and what they hope to get out of him. And then you're given your time, you're given your sort of specified 8 minutes, and you mustn't run over. And it's kind of weird because you're put in this room with lights all around you, loads of people looking on. So there's quite a lot of scrutiny as you're doing this. But for him as well, I thought about this, and this applies to all politicians. He's not an exception, but you've just had however many 3 days of conference, so pretty wiped out by that. You've done a speech where, you know, that's in itself quite an exhausting process. Then you sit down and you effectively go through a job interview and are scrutinised by I don't know, 8 to 10 journalists in interview after interview after interview. It is quite a rigorous process that these people put themselves through. Yeah. And that applies to the leader of the Labour Party, the leader of the Conservative Party, all politicians in this position. That's what they get in the game for, I guess. But it was interesting to kind of see the way it all works behind the scenes. And of course, there was masses to talk about. So you never feel like you get across everything that you want to get across. But you'll hear him talking about freebies, the row over winter fuel payments, homes for veterans, which he announced yesterday. And also, I thought this was interesting, the transition of moving his family into Downing Street and the pressures that had put on them personally. But I started by asking him about his time in Number 10 so far.
We've been acting to plan, which is we said we'd come into government and start by fixing the foundations. And if you look at what we've done in the first 3 months, we've already shown that change has begun. And that's why I listed in my conference speech all the things that we've already done, whether that's setting up the National Wealth Fund, launching Great British Energy, dealing with unlawful evictions, today announcing the Hillsborough Law, which has been too long in the waiting, in my view, making sure that we're going to deal with homelessness for veterans. There's a long list of changes that have already begun. But what I also said today was, it's a long journey. Mm. It's a tough journey. There are going to be trade-offs along the way. But in the long term, the Britain that we're building is going to be a Britain where people are better off, where their public services are working properly. The NHS is back up on its feet.
I understand those are your aspirations, but it has been personally tough for you. Your personal popularity rating has slumped down 21 points amongst all voters, 28 points among Labour voters. That surely can't have been part of the plan. And the row over winter fuel payments and freebies has really bitten hard, hasn't it?
Look, I didn't come into politics to spend my time looking at opinion polls. I'll be judged, and rightly judged, on whether I deliver what I said we'd deliver at the election. So I'll be judged on whether we've improved living standards, whether people feel better off. I'll be judged by whether our public services are back up and functioning as people desperately want. I'll be judged by the NHS. Has it improved? Are the waiting lists down? Is it coping for the future? I'll be judged, the next election on that, and quite rightly so. And, I have to say, that is where my entire focus is. I didn't come into politics to sort of gaze at opinion polls. I came into politics to change lives, and that's been the driver for everything I've
done.
But
you did say, up there on that stage, you said it was a shared struggle. Well, we had this text from a Five Live listener, Ian in Neath, who says, if it's a shared struggle, where are my free clothes?
Well, look,
it doesn't feel like the struggle is being shared equally.
Well, the struggle is across the NHS, across our economy. These are big, serious issues that we are addressing, and they're going to be addressed by taking tough, tough decisions. And I think, what we've shown in the first 3 months is delivery already, considerable delivery, change has begun, a steely determination not to be buffeted around by the issues of the day, but to remind ourselves every day, as I do, that my job is to improve the economy and make sure it works for everyone, to make sure that everybody's better off. That is only going to happen if we take the tough decisions. A terrible inheritance. The government left a complete mess on top of the economic mess. We've discovered this £22 billion black hole. That is really hard to deal with, but we will deal with it. We've inherited a prison system which is bursting at the seams.
But I have to make you aware that our listeners are fully aware of all those issues.
Yeah.
You presented them repeatedly through the election campaign. What they want to know is how you're going to move things on from here. And there is a dissonance between politicians taking thousands of pounds in freebies and pensioners being asked to give up, many of them, this critical payment. Now, can I just look at another issue? For example, on the freebies, you received over the course of the last Parliament £35,000 worth of football tickets for free. The Taylor Swift concert, £4,000 worth of hospitality there from the Premier League. Now, there is an issue there, isn't there? Because your government is engaged in a process of setting up a new football regulator. So if you're taking freebies from the Premier League, can't you see how that raises concerns?
Well, let me just deal with that because, as you know, I'm passionate about football. I go to a lot of football games. I've got season tickets at Arsenal, which I fully pay for. I go with my boy. But because of security that I've had now in place for some time, and obviously that's gone up since I've been Prime Minister, then I can't sit in the stands where my season ticket is anymore. Therefore, the club and other clubs have said, well, you can be our guest in the director's box. Now, that doesn't cost the taxpayer a penny. A sum of money is allocated to it. You don't pay for it because you can't buy a ticket in the director's box, but you allocated a nominal sum towards it. And so that is purely about my passion for watching football and being able to take my son to Arsenal games. In relation to other elements on the register, some of it is for accommodation. When we were running into the election, my son was doing his GCSEs. And we had lots of journalists outside our house. I'm not complaining about that, but I had promised him faithfully that I would give him an environment in which he could calmly get on, his one chance to do his GCSEs, and therefore we relocated somewhere else, a gift, which we then allocated a sum of money to. So sometimes what sits behind these are human explanations. Mm-hmm. But look, now we're in government. I think if you take, for example, clothing, I think that's, you know, when the hurly-burly of an election campaign is one thing. We're in government now, and so you won't see clothing declarations from me again.
So will MPs be able to take freebies in other forms outside of clothing, Labour MPs?
Well, I think every MP has to exercise judgment, and I would expect them to exercise judgment.
So you're not
judgment.
Banning all gifts?
Well, you have to exercise judgment. I expect people to exercise judgment. And the rules in place, the framework, is quite rightly that all has to be declared so that everybody can see it. But my MPs, my cabinet and I are focusing every day on the job we're elected to do, which is to deliver the change for the government,
so let's
for
look
the
at
country.
Important policy announced today, homes for heroes,
yeah.
And care leavers and domestic abuse victims. So what's the detail? How many homes? When are they going to be available? What's that going to cost?
Well, I'm really pleased to make those announcements today because they're very important for veterans, for care leavers and for those who have been subject to domestic abuse. The only reason we can do it is because we changed the planning rules. We've taken a decision which the last government was too afraid to take. So we now need to change the regulations to allow it to happen. But the commitment I've made is that all of those who are homeless will have a roof over their
head.
When
will that happen?
Well, we need to pass the necessary regulation and get on with the job. I haven't got a date, an arbitrary date that I'll give you.
And do you know how many homes you're going to need?
Well, we've looked at the numbers that we need, assessed it, but we're only able to do this because we've turbocharged the planning. That is the only reason
we can make
that
commitment. But I understand that, but you can't tell me the number of homes or how much this is going to cost. You haven't worked that out yet.
No, of course that's been worked out. That is all being worked out by the relevant department. What I announced today is the commitment to do it. And when I make a commitment like that, I also committed to the Hillsborough Law. These are serious commitments. One of my big criticisms of the last government is that it promised things which it didn't deliver. I've been really careful only to promise what we will deliver.
And
it's a huge mistake to do other than that.
Very much on board with
yeah,
that and very
yeah.
interested in that. Just finally, you mentioned your son, and I've got teenage kids. I'm right in the thick of those years, so I absolutely understand those pressures. And I often actually wonder what it is like for them and for you as a family making that transition, the scrutiny of being life in number 10. Can I ask how you are all managing and how that's gone?
Well, look, it's been tough for the kids. I'm not pleading a special case, but it's tough. They're 16 and 13. That's a very sort of important time in their lives. What we've done, Vic and I, is to be really clear that we won't name them in public. We won't have photographs done with them in public. We'll try to sort of put a ring of protection around them so that even living in number 10, as they now are, they can live as normal a life as possible and, you know, go to the same schools, have the same friends, do the same things they did before. And that is the way we've done it up to now. I intend to keep doing it. But, you know, is it really difficult for a 13-year-old girl and a 14-year-old boy to have to relocate from Kentish Town with all their friends, the security of the house, the only house they'd ever lived in, to somewhere else? Yeah, of course it's difficult for
them. Fully appreciate that. Have you managed your Friday night dinner yet?
Well, no, because every Friday night has been mucked up with work. But I think
a few people were suggesting that might happen.
Well, no, but and of course it happened in opposition. The point I was actually making when I talked about that, which I do really stand by, is it is important to carve out time for your family. Whether that time is will vary during the week, but I do genuinely think it's important for all politicians, me in particular, to have a quiet time with my wife and my kids. Whatever day it is, it is really important for the family. I think it's important I think you make better decisions if you sometimes get a little bit of distance and spend a bit of time with your family.
Dragging them to the table is often the hardest part, isn't it? But that's another issue. Thank you, Prime Minister.
Thank you.
So, look, a couple of interesting things to pick out there. One of them is the Homes for Veterans, just to clarify on that. I was trying to understand some of the policy detail around that. What we have subsequently learned is that actually all it is about reprioritising access to social housing. And we still don't really know what that's going to look like in practice.
So no,
but it doesn't
major...
necessarily mean they're not going to go out and build 1,000 new social homes
for these sectors
for veterans.
Right. So it's just reprioritising what they're already doing. Yeah.
Which, you know, that's fine. But it wasn't entirely clear in his speech that that was what he was going to do. Also, the stuff about his son was interesting. The fact that we knew he'd stayed at Lord Alley, this big Labour donor who we talked a lot about recently, we knew he'd stayed at his flat. That had all been declared, but we didn't know the reason behind it. And him now coming out and saying, well, look, it was, you know, it was to protect my family. My son was under all this pressure. He was going through his exams. That's new information, actually. And I thought it was interesting also the way he sort of opened up about how tough it's been on his teenage kids making that transition to Downing Street. But listen, whatever you heard this morning that you want to pick out and text us about, react to, then feel free, 850-58, or you can send a WhatsApp on 08085 909693.
Rob in Plymouth. The morning, Rob's been in touch already saying, I have to say, it's great. We finally have a Prime Minister who really likes football as opposed to pretending to. It's great he wants to go and logical that he go in the director's box. However, this is Phil in Bedfordshire. Thanks for getting in touch, Phil. I was a public sector worker, police officer. If I had taken a gift, it would have been a gratuity. I'd have been sacked. He chooses to go to football. It's not part of his job and he should pay for it, says Phil in Bedfordshire.
And this one, the treatment of this government so far by the British media, including yourselves, is everything that's wrong with this country. You build people up, back them to the hilt, then as soon as they gain some success, you can't wait to knock them down any way you can. The UK media need to be held accountable for the dreadful mood and unrest. I've just lost it there. In this country, whether it's politics, arts, football or anything else, you decide to pick apart as soon as you've elevated it. Let's have some positivity, please. More of your thoughts, please. We'd love those. 850-58, as I say, you know the number. 21 minutes past six.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The Checkered Flag Podcast. Keeping you up to date with everything Formula One.
It has been utter dominance for Lando Norris, who wins the Singapore Grand Prix.
It was an amazing race. A few too many close calls. I'm a bit out of breath, but very fun one.
Next up, Austin, Texas, and an intense six-race sprint to the end of the year.
The Checkered Flag Podcast.
Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Five Live Breakfast. In my opinion.
In my opinion.
In my opinion.
And in my opinion.
That was a very timely trail, Rachel, because today's, in my opinion, is about swearing in sport. It is after Formula One world champion Max Verstappen was handed a punishment for swearing in a news conference. Our guest is all for a bit of swearing.
Hey, Rachel and Claire. My name is Dr. Richard Stevens. I am a psychologist and academic with a long-standing interest in researching the performance-enhancing effects of swearing. And in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with swearing in sports. My university-based research has shown that swearing helps people to endure pain and boosts their physical performance, useful for gaining an edge over your opponents. Research has also shown how in intense, stressful situations, swearing conveys emotion quickly and efficiently like almost no other form of language. Just what you need in a team. Even in Formula One, when drivers who may be teammates curse each other out after being cut up out on track, it's raw, it's real, and sometimes it's exactly what's needed.
Five Live Breakfast.
The voice of the UK.
So we'll talk to Dr. Richard Stevens before eight, but let's hear your thoughts. Andy in Hertfordshire says, I really think swearing in sport is fine, especially playing golf. It can help get frustration out quickly and refocus. I often hear professional golfers swearing on TV.
Yes, don't we all, Andy? But is it a good thing? Dr. Richard Stevens is going to come on. You can text us now, 850-58. You can send us a voice note, 08085 909693. So he's specifically talking about performance, but I guess the argument also follows that if elite sports people swear, then it kind of becomes the fabric of the sport and the people watching it and younger viewers and participants as well. It all has a knock-on effect. So love your views on that one. Keep them coming in. Now, you may remember a few years ago, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg made a massive deal about the metaverse, a new virtual world where people can interact, represented by avatars. Now, for a while, it dominated tech news. Now, Meta, the company which owns Facebook, Instagram and WhatsApp, is hosting a major conference about the metaverse. Let's speak to Head of Impact at Devi and metaverse expert Duncan Murray. Morning, Duncan.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's dive into this world then. What do you think he's going to uncover in this conference? What can we expect from Zuckerberg?
Well, I think these conferences generally are about releasing and explaining what you're working on next, whether it's from a developer point of view or from a hardware point of view. So I think they will have a few areas of announcements. First of all, in the virtual reality and augmented reality, VR and AR, but also in their AI brackets. So they are working very heavily on AI in both the metaverse and their wearables, so that they will have updates there. But also, they'll probably release or announce the release of a few new products in that area. So they have a new Meta Quest 3S, which is a slimmed down version of their larger headset, which hasn't sold that well. So they made it cheaper and slightly more wearable. But also other products such as their mixed reality Ray-Ban smart glasses, which have sold quite well. They'll probably announce a new version of those. Those capture and share pictures as you walk around.
And how are those selling so far then? How are they selling so far, those glasses?
So they've sold better than other attempts, such as Google Glass and Snapchat Spectacle, simply because they partnered with a cool looking brand. You know, they do look a lot better than other glasses. They're relatively for wearables in a good price bracket. They're around £300. So they have actually, of face wearables, they are actually the best selling, and they're probably what the consumers actually want, because one of the issues with larger headsets such as Meta Quest and Apple's Vision is that they're quite large and clunky and people aren't that keen to wear them, and they're more virtual. So you know, you mentioned the metaverse, but those other sets are, they immerse you fully into a virtual experience, whereas the Ray-Ban smart glasses are mixed reality, so you can still see perfectly well, but they, as I said, they allow you to take pictures and video and share on instantly stream actually on Instagram and so on. And then you've also got the Orion glasses, which is a mixture of those. So they not only do what the Ray-Bans do, but they actually project images onto the glasses. So you can see sort of holograms in each eye, and that's as you're walking around. So,
my goodness. And so many questions, not enough time. But safety being one of them, but also data capture as well, because we all know that any time we sign up to whatever new product there is, it's all about kind of monitoring what we're doing, you know, sites we're going, our personal information. So what kind of, we don't have much time, but I mean, what kind of concerns do you have for all of these new products coming on the market?
So that's a very good question. They did have some conversations, or they were paused for a while whilst Meta spoke to what's called the ICO, the Information Commissioner's Office, around the data protection issues, particularly around what people take and use for their AI large language models in Facebook's case, in Meta's case, Llama. But they have agreed that what they can use is publicly available information, so what they post on Instagram and Facebook and so on. So they have come to an arrangement there. So they can't collect all data, but they can collect what is publicly available. And that is the issue, of course, as you mentioned, with many platforms, not just in the metaverse.
Okay, well, I guess, it, you know, when they become a little bit more widespread, we'll see them in action, and you know, all of these questions will still be debated. Duncan, thank you so much for joining us. Head of Impact at Devi, and he's a metaverse expert, Duncan Murray, 28 past six.
So this returned last night. And I was happy to have it back, I really was. The Great British Bake Off back on our screens last night, the 15th series now.
Wow.
Joining us is Lizzie Acker, quarterfinalist from the show in 2021. Hi, Lizzie. Does that give you a kind of warm, fuzzy feeling, that music?
No, it doesn't actually. It sends shivers down my spine.
Even now, after all this time.
Yeah, I think it's just the music of, because you don't actually know how you've been edited.
Yeah.
When you watch it.
So when you're watching
you,
it,
it's a surprise.
It's a whole new experience, of course. When when you see the new contestants come in, 12 of them, although one of them wasn't very well, so couldn't participate in the whole thing last night, but how, what are they going through, particularly in those very early days of this process?
I think they are going through utter shock, because what you see on telly is very different to what it's like to make TV. So no one tells you how many people are going to be in the tent. So the tent's quite full, actually, of, you know, production staff, the cameramen and stuff like that, which might seem like a thought that you're like, oh, of course there's cameramen there. But, you know, when you actually get there and you turn up and you think, oh, this is a lot of camera people. Mm-hmm. I didn't realise that. And the noise level, because you might be used to cooking at home with your mixer on, but then think of 12 people's mixers on, and then them 12 people all talking at the same time as well to explain what they're doing to their cameramen. It's really overwhelming.
That's a lot to take in. And you've been open, Lizzie, about your ADHD, and another of the contestants this time round, Georgie, paediatric nurse from Carmarthenshire, has also spoken about how baking has helped her manage her ADHD. But with that kind of external stimulus, does that become much more challenging then for you in that sort of environment?
Yeah, it does. It definitely throws you off. And also you've got to think about, you know, when they do them beautiful shots where everyone's stood at the table and everyone's getting judged, that takes about 2 hours for that like 2 minute segment. So you've got that thing of, you know, standing in the same place and waiting, and it, all the anxiety is building up. And obviously with ADHD you're a bit like, oh. So I used to be allowed to like walk around, like leave the tent, have a little walk and come back and stuff. And I think Love Productions are very good at making accommodations.
Yeah, no, that is good to hear. So what did you make of the contestants last night? And is there anyone for you who's standing out at this early stage?
So standing out obviously is John, I think, but my favourite is Hazel.
The older lady.
Yeah. With her eyelashes and her fantastic nails. I was like,
well, she was a nail technician for many years, wasn't she? But you're absolutely right. She presents herself very well and she's got the most fantastic smile.
Yeah, she was amazing. Also, when they made their hyper-realistic cakes, Hazel's bag you could actually pick up. I don't know how more hyper-realistic you can get.
It was brilliant. We're not going to spoil it for people who haven't seen it yet. So we won't tell you the actual outcome, who left, who stayed, Star Baker and all of that. What did you make, just finally, of the little twist on the technical challenge everyone is talking about? So you didn't get the amounts of ingredients that you normally get. Instead, they showed you an example of the Battenberg cake, which you were allowed to pick apart and taste and feel, but then you just had to work it out on your own.
So I don't think it's much different. I think it's, in a way, a bit nicer, because it used to be, you on your ingredient sheet, it never used to tell you the method anyway or what to do. It would simply say,
it's just the amounts, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, and bake the sponge.
Right.
So you'd have to go off anyway. So if you had a visual of, you know, what colours they're going for and what it looks like, it's a bit easier, because there was a couple of years ago where Dave had to make a cornucopia and he done it backwards. And that's just because you haven't seen what it looks like. So it's a bit easier to have a visual and then go off it.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if they carry this on through the whole series.
It will. I do think, you know, for the more obscure bakes that you've never seen before, it gives you something to aim for in your head before you start baking, which can be a lot easier, because the old technical list never even had a temperature on anyway.
Right.
So you're guessing constantly.
So you're working blind pretty much anyway. Lizzie, we're going to have to leave it, but thank you so much for talking to us. It's nice to be chatting about it again. All the best.
Isn't it? All right. See you later.
Take care. Bye. Lizzie Acker. She was in Bake Off in 2021. There was a handshake last night, a Paul Hollywood handshake, which
was
very unusual.
Yeah.
It did look good. It was a cinnamon loaf that Ilian had baked. So, yeah, that's on Channel 4 if you want to catch up with it now.
Yeah, still to come on Five Live Breakfast. Sean is going to be here from Wake Up to Money. He's going to be here to talk about whether we're using wallets anymore. Real wallets, not virtual wallets or fantasy wallets or whatever they were doing on Bake Off. That on the way. Let's get the news headlines.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Sir Keir Starmer has warned Brits still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. The Prime Minister says the government is ramping up contingency plans. British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations.
There's growing unease within the NHS in England about the government's message the health service is broken. Senior sources have told the BBC they believe some of the comments could result in lasting damage to patient and staff confidence in the NHS.
Prosecutors in the US have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Ruth, who's 58, was already facing two gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida earlier this month.
And according to global research, children's eyesight is getting steadily worse. One in three now short-sighted. Analysts say COVID lockdowns had a negative impact as children spent more time on screens. Japan and South Korea have some of the highest rates of short-sightedness.
Let's check in with the weather again. And Helen.
Hello there, Claire. Good morning, Rachel, as well. Hello at home. Well, if you're waking up this morning, more rain on the way. Scotland are seeing mostly showers and they're going to be more frequent in the northern West Isles and northwest Highlands, getting more frequent actually as the strengthening northeasterly wind makes things feel really chilly, just 10 degrees. But actually, even though it's a cold, frosty start in places, there'll be plenty of sunshine, a little bit of fog around to clear, but it looks like a fairly decent day, dry and bright with some sunshine through the central belt until later, 13 here. A few showers for the east of Northern Ireland, but essentially here too, it's a dry, bright, cold start with some good spells of sunshine, but the cloud does come in through the afternoon. The rain follows this evening. But across England and Wales, well, we've already got rain in the south, pulses of rain, and they will steadily push their way northwards and eastwards through the day. So the northeast of England lasts to get the rain, but when it does arrive here, it will linger through tonight and into tomorrow as well. So there's concerns for further flood issues. We're going to get another inch of rain potentially further south anyway on those areas badly affected on Monday, where there are still numerous flood warnings in force. So temperatures fairly academic today, about 12 or 13, 17 if we see some brightness later in the southwest. But it's windy too with the rain, particularly in the south.
Thanks, Helen. How about the roads, Orna?
Well, busy already on the M25. So junction 25 at Enfield, an accident's happened. One lane's closed for recovery. It happened in the roadworks and it's already queuing back to the M11 at junction 27. That's anti-clockwise. You've also got queues either side of the Wisley interchange of the A3, junction 10. That's roadworks. The A421 is closed because of flooding. It's still closed from Marshalley's roundabout to the M1 at junction 13 for Bedford. And then queues on the M20 coastbound, junction 4 at Leybourne. An accident in one of the lanes. Also, Eurotunnel, it's a wait time of an hour for passenger services at Folkestone at the moment. Orna Merchant, Five Live Travel.
The voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Great to have your company. Rachel and Claire with you today. 23 minutes to 7. And Katie joins us in the studio. Morning again.
Good morning.
Great sweatshirt, by the way.
Thank you very much.
Drop that in. Now, let's move on to Sporting Matters England. They did, in fact, keep their ODI series with Australia alive yesterday. Really impressive at Durham, weren't they?
Yeah, it'd been quite a tough watch, hadn't it, in the first two matches. Convincing losses. England, we've talked a lot about being in this rebuilding phase of their white ball squad. So hard to sense what expectations are. But they had to chase a target of 305 set by Australia, who batted first. Harry Brook hitting at 110 not out is his first ODI century and guided his side to a 46-run win. It was via the Duckworth Lewis Stern method, so it was a rain-affected match. England, though, had come from this position of being 11 for 2. A really calm and composed knock from the standing skipper.
Not just the ODIs, but this summer I've felt like I haven't performed as well as I could have done. I haven't got the amount of runs I wanted to get. Obviously, high expectations and all that, but no, yeah, I didn't feel like my game was in best order, but yeah, it's nice to get a score out there.
So the fourth match is on Friday at Lord's, of course, must win again for England in this five-match series. In other cricket news as well, quite interesting, minimum starting salaries are going to be made equal for men and women in the domestic game from next year. So at the top counties, that figure for rookies will be at £20,000 and £28,000 for senior professionals.
Now, the Premier League teams all made it through to the fourth round of the EFL Cup last night, but sadly, and you could say, I guess, rather predictably, Chelsea didn't go easy on Barrow, did they?
Well, listen to this. It was Premier League big spenders 5, League 2 leaders 0. CBS were reporting this after the game, that the £200 million that Chelsea spent on last night's starting front four, and you've got to remember they made 11 changes from their Premier League match of the weekend, that would cover Barrow's player wage bill for the next century.
What?
Yeah.
Wasn't it? That's not a level playing field.
But that is the ridiculous money we're talking about at Chelsea at the moment. So 52 million, Christopher Nkunku, he scored a hat trick. Pedro Neto, 54 million price tag, got his first goal as well. Here's the boss, Enzo Maresca, pretty happy.
I said the other day after West Ham, probably the way we are playing, I think we are ahead where I expected. But the important thing is that, as I said, no matter who is going to play, you can see the identity of the team and we need to continue in that way.
Manchester City made 9 changes. They beat Watford 2-1. We talked a lot about Rodri's injury yesterday. Pep Guardiola says the severity is still yet to be confirmed, but he admits he will be out for a long time. Aston Villa beat Wycombe Wanderers 2-1. Leicester, though, needed penalties to get past League 2's Walsall. And AFC Wimbledon are still dealing with the flooding, the severe flooding at their stadium. So more than 100,000 litres of water have been pumped out of Plough Lane. They don't know when they'll be able to play again, but they've started this crowdfunding campaign that's already raised £93,000, including a £15,000 donation from Newcastle United, who was supposed to play them there yesterday. Here's their managing director, James Woodruff.
You know, it really does typify the community spirit associated with our club. Yeah. And we're very proud of our fan base. And, you know, we're eternally grateful to anyone who, big or small, you know, we've got former players making donations. You know, it's just magical.
Mark Allen is still in the British Open snooker. He beat Aaron Hill to reach round 3 yesterday. But this comes after his comments in Cheltenham saying that it was unplayable, that the table should be burnt. He then apologised to Rob Walker after that third round win in an interview for those comments. Kat Ferguson, Felix Barrow and Fran Brown all took gold as GB won 9 medals at the Road and Paracycling World Championships. And the Chicago White Sox haven't taken the unwanted record of the worst season in modern baseball history yet, because they won overnight against the Los Angeles Angels, but their 120 defeats this season has already tied the record from 1962.
Ouch. Thank you, Katie. Morning, everyone. If you're just joining us, it's Claire and Rachel here on Five Live Breakfast this morning. I've been in Liverpool. I've spoken to the Prime Minister. We'll bring you that interview after 7 o'clock. If you're just joining us, he's talked about lots of things. MPs getting freebies, homes for heroes, the pressures on his family since he's moved into 10 Downing Street. Couple of texts. Morning, our Prime Minister's children are privileged, and whilst I understand the Prime Minister's concern about his children's education, they are under a lot less pressure than a lot of children who are living in poverty. That's Mandy in Fife. This is in response to the fact that he stayed in Lord Ali's flat during the general election campaign in order to offer more protection to his son, who was going through his GCSEs at the time. And this one, because he also talked about the reason he went to the football, took those free tickets, he really wanted to take his son. Maybe he has to tell his son he can't go to the football if it's such a big security risk. They really don't understand the metrics and the perception of accepting all these gifts. There is no change. The economy has got worse since they came in due to their negative rhetoric. Pensions are going to be cold this winter. They can't all move into a gifted house, says Ben in Worthing. Thank you for those. Right, Sean is here from Wake Up to Money.
Good morning.
About wallets this morning, which really took off, didn't it?
Yeah, it did, because what the data has shown is that the number of people mainly using cash for day-to-day spending hit a 4-year high during the very heights of the cost of living crunch that many people are still experiencing now. But when I talk about the heights, I mean those moments when prices were shooting up 10% or more. People hadn't seen wage increases or pension increases coming through. You know, there was certain pinch points where people found it, their budgets being particularly squeezed very quickly, still may well do today. But so a lot more people were using cash. 1.5 million adults mainly using cash in 2023. That was the first rise, you know, since 2019. And so on Wake Up to Money, we were just, our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachy had a bit of a look at the world of manufacturing wallets. You know, is there a keenness out there? And plenty of people getting in touch saying, still keen on the wallet, cash has to be king, shouldn't be allowed to have contactless only places, should be made illegal. But at the same time, lots of people saying, haven't used a wallet, haven't used a card for a very long time now. And the idea of tracking your stuff one way or another. So either the ability of having it on your phone. So if you happen to lose your phone, you can use your Find My iPhone or whatever the Android equivalent might be. The ability that if you've lost it, you can find it was a key part of that, which brought us on to AirTags on wallets. People
Oh, really?
Sticking them on their wallet.
Talking about air tags on children the other day.
Yes, well, yeah, it's a similar kind of thing. You don't want to lose either.
So I had to use a card yesterday and punch in my PIN number, and I just got so irritated by the friction that that generated in my life when I'm used to this kind of fluid wafting of my phone. But the other thing was I was driving back from the interview with Keir Starmer and I suddenly got very hungry, so decided to stop off at a garage and buy a packet of crisps. £1.40. £1.40.
I was saying to you earlier, I think you went for the grab bag.
There's only a grab bag.
Oh, no, isn't there? You can only
That's
do
the only
that.
Option. Anyway, I happened to have precisely £1.39 in my purse,
which I counted out
in pennies. He let me off the penny. I said, are you sure? I
can put it.
I just didn't want to get my card out for £1.40 or whatever. So I did. But that's the first time I've used cash in a long time.
Yeah, to pay for an item, that is that is quite something.
Literally, I counted out one penny piece.
Did he look at you with disgust?
I think he looked
what
at
are you
like
doing?
I was from 1972 or something.
Where have they been? Yeah, now for me, the wallet is a holiday thing. So I have a wallet and it's actually fully prepared for any foreign trips.
Is it?
But I'm not carrying it everywhere. It's just, it's in the,
you've got a stash of euros in it, have you?
Some euros, but when I say foreign trips, I just mean a different county.
That's foreign to you, Sean.
It's going a long way. If you're taking two kids with you,
that's life
like
of kids, isn't it?
Going around
that is
the world.
A foreign trip.
Yeah. So it just,
Lancashire.
But you know, if you come across the wrong ice cream van that isn't taking contactless or something like that, I mean, most of you these days. Yeah. So very interesting though that the return to the wallet or purse did set alight that conversation. There's a very broad spectrum of habits now. Some people completely ditched the old clicky purse in the handbag or the wallet that you might have, and just fully putting their faith in a charged up smartphone. But that does mean, which I use a lot, I've always got a backup charger as well, so may as well just carry a wallet around me in the first place.
Thank you very much, Sean. Sean Farrington, loads more discussion on that if you want to go back and listen to the Wake Up to Money podcast on BBC Sounds.
Yeah, I did think, you know, once you could do that at an ice cream van, you know, we have jumped the shark now. It's over.
It's true.
Cash is... It's not, obviously, but that was like, whoa, you've got one of those things? Now...
We do it for our school PTA donations.
Do you?
Absolute winner. Being able to do cashless donations and paying for stuff.
Yeah.
So no parent can go, oh, I haven't got... Yes, you have.
Yes, you have.
I can see your phone.
We've all got it.
Stick it on that QR code.
Cough it up. We will bring you the latest on Lebanon shortly. Of course, the Prime Minister flew just after Rachel's interview with him, actually, to the UN in New York and has issued a statement advising UK citizens to leave Lebanon. So more on that from our correspondent out there shortly. But we're going to talk about this first of all. A study has found a rising number of teenagers are showing addictive behaviour when it comes to social media. Data from the World Health Organization shows problematic use is common amongst 13-year-olds. And girls are more likely to be affected than boys. Let's speak to Dr. Jo Inchley from the University of Glasgow, who is involved in the study. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's good to have you on, because obviously this is a concern for many parents. So tell us what you found, and why is it girls being affected more negatively than boys, would you say?
So we look at social media use more generally across many countries in Europe and North America. But this was a sort of standout finding, really, that more problematic use is on the increase, and particularly in the UK. So we've had a doubling of problematic use from about 10% to around just over 20% amongst girls, 13-year-old girls in Scotland and England in the last 4 years. So, I mean, girls are more likely to use social media than boys anyway. We know that boys are more likely to play online games. But why we've seen the specific rise amongst 13-year-olds is we don't really know. It's likely due to a number of different factors.
Right. And would COVID be one of them?
So COVID could be one of them. I mean, we're comparing 2018 with 2022. So obviously the pandemic was a huge thing in between, and young people started using digital technology a lot more to talk to their friends. But again, that was common to young people across Europe. So although we've seen a kind of common increase across many countries in problematic use, which is likely linked to COVID, among other things, there's a steeper increase in the UK, which we don't yet know why.
And when you say problematic, is this the length of time teenagers are spending on their devices, or is it what they're looking at, or is it a combination of both?
Yeah, so we use a special measure. It's called the Social Media Disorder Scale. So it's looking at addiction-like symptoms. We're not measuring addiction per se, but it really is talking about not just the time they're spending, but how it affects their lives. So we're looking at things like, does it mean you neglect other activities in your life? Are you always thinking about going on social media when you're not on it? Do you find it really hard to come off? Are you starting to lie to people about the amount of time you're spending on social media? So these are some of the questions that we ask. So it's really when it's starting to have a negative impact on other aspects and relationships in their lives.
So that, for parents listening and teenagers listening as well, those are the sort of questions you have to ask yourself. And if you've got too many yeses, maybe have a rethink.
Yeah, I mean, I think social media use is everywhere, right? So we're not saying that's a bad thing per se. But yes, when a young person is maybe withdrawing from other activities, when it's interfering with their relationships with friends and family, then that might be a red flag. That's the time to start having a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's an awful lot of children who find it quite difficult to form friendships. And it's such a turbulent time, the teenage years. And it's an absolute minefield sometimes with teenagers falling in and out of friendship groups. There can be a lot of safety in forming friendships online, obviously, with people you know you're talking to, and it's a safe environment. But there's quite a few positives as well, aren't there?
Yeah, and there's loads of positives. You're absolutely right. So it's a really important means of communication for young people at that age, as they're sort of discovering their own sense of self and social identity. And a lot of that's now happening in the online world. It builds community. It's a form of entertainment, you know, as well as information sharing. So huge benefits. So the real question is, how do we promote healthy behaviours online? How do we ensure an appropriate balance between the advantages of digital engagement and then some of the risks that we know it can bring, particularly for vulnerable young people?
So you've raised that question, but you also suggest through the report that we need better enforcement of age restrictions by social platforms. And obviously the government have said, you know, this is something they're interested in. What are you recommending? What should happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right, that governments need to work with industry to find appropriate ways to manage age-appropriate content online and make sure that young people aren't being exposed to harmful content online. So that's really important. And then I think there's also a role to play around digital literacy in schools, for example, just helping young people to gain the skills that they need to effectively navigate the online world and to start that young enough so that it's, developmentally appropriate and as they grow through adolescence.
Great advice, really interesting research. Thank you so much for bringing it to us. And that is Dr Jo Inchley from the University of Glasgow. As ever, your views welcome. 85058, 9 minutes to seven.
This is all smoke and mirrors. That's sales.
On BBC iPlayer.
What have you got to offer me?
Look, this is in all of our interests, right?
The new series of Industry.
I'm so glad you came.
Starring Kit Harington.
I'm an investment banker. Did you invite me here to watch you eat?
No, I invited you here to seduce you.
I've never met anyone with a bigger blind spot.
All's fair in love and war, right?
I needed my friend and you used me.
Industry.
Now, we go to work.
Starts Tuesday on BBC iPlayer.
Good morning, everyone. 6:51. There's an interesting story on the BBC News website this morning about children's eyesight. Global analysis suggesting it's getting steadily worse. So one in three children now short-sighted or unable to see things in the distance clearly. Researchers reckon that COVID lockdowns have had a negative impact because of kids spending more time on screens, less time outdoors. Being outdoors, I think, is good for your eyesight, isn't it? Exposure to wider sort of aspects,
yeah,
plus sunlight and
vitamin
all of that.
D.
Yes, 85% of children in Asia are affected, much less in the UK and Ireland, 15% here and in the US as well. So we'll try and find out more about that story later in the programme.
Before 8, we'll be joined by this man.
This man. Lovely quick hands. It's a run to the line for Bigger. Dan Bigger goes over the line. Bigger with the early attempt at a drop goal. He's got underneath it and it's over. What a start for Wales. 30 seconds gone.
Bigger's under the post. Dan Bigger for Wales, who lead in the quarter-final.
Was there ever a more appropriately named rugby player? Welsh rugby great Dan Bigger is going to be joining us in the studio. Retired from Wales now, but still playing for Toulon. He'll be here in the studio ahead of the release of his autobiography, The Bigger Picture.
Now, has he had that title in his head for many years, do you think?
All his life.
He actually said he wasn't particularly interested in doing an autobiography, but as is often the case, a couple of people said, actually, I think people would really want to hear your story. And reading a bit around it, I haven't had a chance to read the book, he's it's fascinating because he's had this phenomenally successful career for Wales and for his clubs. And he's still playing in Toulon in the south of France. But he says that reflecting back, he can see how his career was peppered with disappointments time and time again. But that is, of course, what also has kind of driven him on to achieve what he has. So we're looking forward to chatting to him a little bit later on. Now, following our interview yesterday in Liverpool, the Prime Minister then travelled to New York for the annual UN General Assembly. But in the meantime, the situation in Lebanon getting increasingly precarious, and he's warned British nationals there to leave immediately. He also said the government was ramping up contingency plans, so 700 British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations. Let's talk to our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Bechega, who's in the capital of Lebanon, Beirut. Hugo, can I ask, first of all, what it's like there at the moment, and are you going to stay there for the time being?
Yes, I think I'm staying here, and this is my city. This is where I live. I'm based here. I've been based here for a year now, and I think there is a sense that things have changed. I think people now are very concerned that this could be the beginning of a wider Israeli offensive against Hezbollah. And we've seen those airstrikes. There is speculation that there could be a ground invasion of southern Lebanon to try to create a so-called buffer zone along the border. And Hezbollah is not showing any signs, any indications that it is willing to back down. So these attacks are likely to continue. So I think the concern now across the country is that this has the potential to become a major war between Hezbollah and Israel.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like, as I say, a very precarious situation. Is there a sense that people are beginning to leave the country, or at least move away from that border with Israel?
Yeah, we've seen a massive displacement of residents from southern Lebanon. Tens of thousands of people are now trying to leave southern Lebanon. I was in a shelter here in Beirut yesterday where 6,000 people, displaced residents, were sheltering. And I don't get a feeling that people are desperately trying to leave the country, because this is a conflict that has been happening for almost a year. There have been some cases of people, thinking that the situation had become too risky for them to stay. So I think people who perhaps don't want to be in the country and don't want to be in a situation where there is a war happening around them, they have already left the country. But I think what is happening now is that you see again countries urging their citizens to leave Lebanon, because the problem here is that there's only one functioning commercial airport. So if this airport has to suspend its operations, many people are stuck here, because the only way to leave the country by land is through Syria, which is obviously not an option for many people. So that's why, one of the reasons why I think lots of countries are now urging their countries, their citizens, to leave the country.
Hugo, thank you very much. 569 people at least killed in 2 days in those Israeli strikes on Lebanon, including 50 children. It is, as I say, an increasingly difficult situation there, and we'll wait to see how the UN General Assembly, which is meeting today, addresses it. It's 6:57.
Yeah, we'll be talking to Sir Mark Lyle-Grant, former UK ambassador to the UN, later in the programme. Now, we have a thrilling climax for England's three-match netball series being played in Australia. The hosts won the first match, England won the second. Their first win over Australia on their own patch since their historic Commonwealth gold in 2018, and it beautifully sets up a series decider in Victoria. 10 o'clock this morning, we can talk to Roses head coach Jess Thelby. Jess, hello.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's fantastic it's gone to this. How are you feeling?
Yeah, really looking forward to it. It's we've given ourselves a fantastic opportunity, and if we were to get over the line in this third match, then it'll be the first time any Roses team has beaten Australia in a three-match series over here. So it's an exciting opportunity, and one hopefully we will grab today and give it our very best.
What has changed since the opener then? I mean, you're performing really well. Did it even out though with injured tutor Eleanor Caldwell against a full-strength Australia?
Yeah, I don't, you know, there were long moments in the first test where we still showed great signs, but I don't think we kind of like stood up to the physicality, the speed of the ball as quickly as we should have, given the preparation. We were training very, very well. So I know there was a tinge of disappointment and frustration at the end of that game, but enough within it that it kind of spurred us on to that test two to put out a better performance than that we did. And it is a quick turnaround here. Lots of travel across the country in between. And it's a real testament to this team that we were able to turn that around. As you say, absorbing both the losses of Eleanor Cardwell and Nat Metcalf, it's very, very pleasing to see an evolving Roses side with youngsters having never played in Australia or against Australia really step up and contribute to the team's performances so far.
Yeah, but you also have Helen Halsby, the only member of the team that played in the Commonwealth Games final in 2018. So how is it having her there to say, look, this is what it feels like, this is what we can achieve?
Yeah, we've got Helen and Beth, actually, who now can boast having beaten Australia, the only two athletes actually to have beaten Australia twice over here. So I think it is always obviously great to have some real role models and those that have experienced it before. Helen plies her trade over here and in their domestic competition. So I think there's kind of like an almost that demystifying the Aussies over the last 5 to 10 years has been a really important mental process more than anything. And obviously Helen is a huge target for them to try and stop and slow down. And that's why to have seen her joined by debutante Lois Pearson, Liv Cheen in that attack and end, Imogen Allison, getting better and better with every game just means that we're stronger as a unit, not just these individuals.
We wish you all the best, Jess. Roses head coach Jess Thelby into that decider 10 a.m. this morning. Good luck.
The Voice of the UK.
This is Five Live Breakfast.
Five Live Breakfast, Rachel Byrne and Claire McDonald with you today. Thank you for your company. Here are the news headlines at 7 o'clock. Sir Keir Starmer has warned Brits still in Lebanon to leave immediately as violence between Israel and Hezbollah escalates. Speaking on board a plane to New York, where he will attend the annual UN General Assembly, the Prime Minister said the government was ramping up contingency plans. Our diplomatic correspondent is James Landale.
He said that we are potentially at what he called a brink point and we have to come back from that brink. We need a ceasefire, we need to de-escalate. And this is something that I think most of the leaders who are here in New York at the UN are, they're saying that, they're saying it to each other, they're saying it to anybody who can listen. And that is because there's a genuine fear that there will be further escalation, that this isn't the end of, you know, what we've seen over the last week or so is not the end of it.
British troops are being sent to Cyprus to help possible evacuations in Lebanon.
Well, before the Prime Minister headed to New York, he did an interview with us here for Five Live Breakfast, which we'll play you in just a moment. And he told me his MP should exercise judgment when it comes to donations of clothing and gifts. One of the things we spoke about was gifted accommodation during the election campaign.
My son was doing his GCSEs. We had lots of journalists outside our house. I'm not complaining about that, but I had promised him faithfully that I would give him an environment in which he could calmly get on his one chance to do his GCSEs, and therefore we relocated somewhere else, a gift, which we then allocated a sum of money to. So sometimes what sits behind these are human explanations. Mm-hmm. But look, now we're in government. I think if you take, for example, clothing, I think that's, you know, when the hurly-burly of an election campaign is one thing. We're in government now, and so you won't see clothing declarations from me again.
Senior sources have told the BBC there's growing unease within the NHS in England about the government's message that the health service is broken. Some hospital leaders have expressed their concerns ahead of the Health Secretary's speech to the Labour Party conference this morning.
Prosecutors in the United States have charged a man with the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Ryan Ruth was already facing 2 gun-related charges after he was accused of pointing a rifle through a fence at Mr. Trump's golf club in Florida.